Whether you like history or not, if you care about bravery, wisdom, passion, larger-than-life characters, and some of the most emotionally intense moments in human experience, you've come to the right place. Daniele Bolelli is a university history professor, writer, and martial artist, and he shall be your guide in a journey to the place where history and epic collide.
The show is brought to you by Only.com, a human optimization site carrying a variety of products designed to help people function at their physical and mental best, from supplements to food to fitness equipment. Check out Only products and receive a 10% discount when you order at www.onnit.com/history. The show is also brought to you by Chimera Coffee. Chimera Coffee was created by four friends who decided to kiss goodbye to the 9-to-5 jobs they hated, to instead team up with former UFC fighter Jake Shields and produce some of the very best coffee in the world by mixing high-altitude coffee with their own nootropic blend. Use the code HISTORY at chimeracoffee.com for a 10% discount. That is KIMERAKOFFEE.com. If you didn't catch some of the above websites, the links are in the episode notes at the History on Fire podcast website. More information on how to support the show and make sure it stays viable for a long time will be at the end of the episode. But now, without further ado, let's go set history on fire. Capua is a town in southern Italy, just a few miles away from modern-day Naples. There's a road there that was built in ancient times, known as the Appian Way, which connects Capua to Rome. Give or take, the distance is about 120-125 miles. If you happen to be there in the late spring of the year 71 before Common Era, and you were to take your first step from Capua toward Rome, you'd immediately run into the body of a man nailed to a cross. Your ears should be struck by the mix of screaming, crying, grunting, and all the other noises that's legitimate to expect a human body to make when it has iron spikes piercing its wrists and feet, and is left to hang from a piece of wood with no water and food for days. If disturbed by this, you decide to walk a little further down the road, things are not gonna get any better. About 30 yards later, you would run into another body nailed to a cross. Same screaming, same crying, same grunting. Now, take what you just seen, and heard, and smelled, and multiply that first crucifixion scene about 6,000 times, with one body every 30 to 40 yards, all the way from Capua to Rome. The entire road would appear from a distance as covered with some kind of signposts, but once you go closer, you will realize that every one of those signposts carries a human body. They are all crosses with 6,000 crucified people on them. That visual is how the last great slave rebellion in ancient Rome ended. That's the finale to one of the most famous slave wars in ancient history. This is Spartacus' rebellion. Not only one of the most famous slave wars in ancient history, this is really one of the greatest wars of resistance ever. You know, there's large-scale slave rebellions have always been fairly rare in world history. There have been two prior to Spartacus. There have been two slave wars that had wrecked the Roman Empire for a while. Both of them had taken place in Sicily before the third one initiated by Spartacus. Spartacus was the third and last. Likely, the 6,000 crucified bodies have something to do with the fact of this one being the last. and no one else trying to rebel in the same way after this moment, since clearly challenging Roman powers would result in the most horrifying of deaths possible. When I told this tale to my friend Joe Rogan, he was quite struck by the story. Considering that Joe has helped me so much, got started in podcasting, and in so many ways, he's the reason why I'm podcasting. I wouldn't have started my first podcast. I probably wouldn't have done this one either. So I feel that it seems like a fitting homage to him to begin the History on Fire podcast series with this particular story. What we'll play with today is not just going to be Spartacus Rebellion, but we are going to cover all three of the great slave wars that took place in ancient Rome. Or at least we're going to try. We'll see. I don't want to abuse of your patience on the very first episode, so we'll see how long we run. If this episode end up running too long, we may just cover the first two wars in this episode and we'll save Spartacus for the next one, or we'll combine it all at once. We're going to find out in a little bit. In any case, the one thing that we should do before tackling any of the three great slave wars is to get a little background about slavery in the Roman world. Now, slavery, unfortunately, is one of those ugly sides of the human experience. It's one of those uncomfortable truths that fact of the matter is that slavery has been normal in many, many societies throughout history. The ancestors of most everyone on Earth have probably been slaves, and they have also probably been somebody who owned slaves. That's the reality of the game. It happened over and over again throughout history. In some cases, this may be very recent, you know, just a few generations ago. In some cases, it may be in a very distant past, hundreds or even thousands of years ago. But the odds are high that somebody in your family line was on both sides of the slavery issue, both as an enslaved person and as a slave owner. Roman society was no exception, actually far from it. Roman society was very much built on slave labor. Some historians believe that in Italy, around the time of right about 2,000 years ago, give or take a century or two, possibly about 20% of the whole population, or even possibly as high as one-third, like 33% of the whole population were slaves. We're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 to 3 million people just for the area of modern-day Italy alone. Forget even the rest of the Roman Empire. Slaves were so common that the price was often fairly cheap. About 2,000 years ago, it is said that for a slave from Gaul, which would be modern-day northern Italy and France, could be traded for just a single amphora of wine. Ending up as a slave in the Roman world is a process that could happen in a bunch of ways. One could end up as a slave because of debt. One could end up as a slave because of some other kind of crime. But the most typical scenario was slavery because of war. In many cases, slavery was a motivation for war. It was a way to make money by warfare. You know, generals could often sell thousands of slaves after a successful campaign. And even legionaries could get quite a few slaves and could get, you know, by conquering people and capturing them. And then, you know, the Roman armies often had slave dealers following them around and buying slaves in mass number right there and there, right after the battle. And then they would take care of moving them to the markets to sell them for a profit. Piracy and kidnapping also contributed to the slave trade. So it's not just through warfare, but warfare was probably the most typical way in which somebody could end up as a slave. Despite the crazy high numbers of people involved in slavery in the ancient world, there's nothing written by slaves or former slaves about their experiences in the Roman world. So because all of those voices are silent in history, we have nothing left. The reality is that the only thing we hear about slavery in the Roman world come from accounts written down by the upper classes. And the connection with the upper classes is, so obviously a lot of our sources are biased, inevitably. The other thing that's interesting regarding the connection between slavery and the upper classes is that some of the great accomplishment of the Roman upper classes were possible because of slavery. Old slavery had been, you know, in the early days of the Roman Empire, slavery was typically household slaves, meaning a few people who would live in the house with the slave owners, help around the house, help around the farm. But the great military success that Rome saw as time went by meant that massive numbers of slaves made their way into the Roman slave market, leading to something known as latifundia. Latifundia are basically big estates by the ultra-rich landowners, and these guys would then have these giant farms that would produce food, not so much for local consumption and subsistence, they would be for sale on the marketplace, and this would allow the owners to make insane profits, pretty much something never seen before. Now, in an odd kind of way, these will end up undermining the very foundations of Roman society, since the super rich will be able to amass even more wealth in proportion that had never been seen before. This wealth will allow them to basically rig the whole Roman political system for their own short-term benefit, but ultimately undermining the safety and solidity of the foundation of the Roman system. You know, the dramatic increase in corruption preventing those very reforms that would have made the society a bit more fair and less likely to explode was made possible thanks to the wealth made through slavery. Problem is that some of those reforms would have stood in the way of the ultra-rich amassing even more power and wealth, and so logically they used their power and wealth to block them, to make sure that these things would not happen. This made perfect sense for them as individuals wanting to maximize their power, but it also spelled doom for Roman society as a whole, leading eventually to the implosion of Roman society, a whole series of civil wars, and the breakdown of the Republic. This, however, is not going to happen for a few decades after the stories that we're going to be discussing today. But before tackling the stories, a couple more things about Roman slavery. Like in many other parts of the world, slavery in the Roman world meant that not all people who were enslaved were born equal. You know, you could be a slave in a mine, which basically meant a death sentence after weeks, months, or years of mind-numbing, body-breaking labor. Typically, this was only for males. Women would not be sent to the slave mines. You could also be enslaved in a rather different way. You could be a highly educated slave, often coming from Greece, who were used by rich families to educate their kids. Well, in that case, if you were in that scenario, your experience of slavery would be pretty different from the guy who's slowly dying in the mines. In many cases, these type of high-level slaves, so to speak, were treated fairly well by the slave owners, had a considerably better life than some of their counterparts. So this distinction in status among slaves, the fact that not all slaves were the same, meant that there really was no solidarity among all of them. Kind of like the stereotype that you hear about slavery in the United States, about the house slaves and the field slave, same thing was going on here. You know, the relationship with slave owners, anything could happen. You know, in some cases, there are cases of slaves and slave owner getting along famously, even cases of them falling in love, if you believe the accounts at least. You hear stories where the most insane brutality took place. You hear, you know, everything was possible. It was really just a matter of luck of who ended up being your slave owner. Obviously, the whole system of slavery is based on violence. You know, you cannot have slavery without violence. Nobody, you can just show up at somebody's door and say, hey, want to be my slave? And they will say, sure, no problem. You know, obviously you need to have the threat of violence or the actual practice of violence to keep them in line. Flogging was one of the most typical thing. Random beatings were also typical to keep a slave in line and afraid of the slave owner. But also, if you're unlucky, you could just run into some particularly mean slave owner and just uncommon types of sadism, and you know, you'll be punished not because of anything you did or to keep the system going, but because these guys got off on other people's pain. There's a famous story, for example, about the Roman Emperor Caligula, who the story goes that he had a slave who stole a piece of a silver plate during a dinner. So once he was caught, he had him beat, he had his hands chopped off, and he was then paraded around the dinner table with his hands hanging from his neck, tied around his neck. You know, that's taking it a few notches up from the regular type of punishment for misbehavior. There really was no recourse if you had a bad slave owner. You know, there are a few laws against abusing slaves, but they were largely unenforced. So the reality is that there really was no restraint. There was nothing that if you, a slave owner, wanted to do horrible things to you, you were pretty close to being out of luck. You know, the only restraint was their own decision-making or conscience or something like that. There really was no legal mean for a slave to be protected. So it was really just a roll of the dice whether things could work out semi-decently for you or not so much. Now, it's true that for slave owners, sometimes it was the smart thing to do to treat their slaves somewhat tolerably. Making small concessions was a way to buy their loyalty, in a way, and to motivate them to work. Slaves knew that if they were loyal and they did what their slave owner wanted, they would be liked by them, and maybe after a lifetime of work, they may even be freed at some point. Typically, a freed slave was still required to perform some work for the owner, which could be good for both, because at least one would no longer be a slave and would have freedom, but at the same time, the slave owner shouldn't go through economic loss, and so they would be more inclined to free some of their slaves. Now, being freed was not necessarily a barrel of monkeys. You know, it could be tough because you had no economic security and you'd start at the very, very bottom of society. However, obviously, most slaves wanted this, wanted a chance to try it out. You know, occasionally slave owners would give slaves a day off or would allow them to work for money to buy their freedom, at least during some of the time, you know, slowly accumulating money with side jobs and eventually buying their freedom. The fact that there were so few rebellions throughout the entire time in which the Roman Republic first and the Roman Empire later stood around, which we're talking about many, many centuries, the fact that there were so few rebellions always puzzled people. It's like if slavery is so intolerable and, you know, it would be weird to argue otherwise, why is it that there were so few rebellions? You know, in some way we're picturing a whole lot of, you know, mass Stockholm syndrome with slaves somehow just buying into the mindset of the slave owners and in some way being controlled by them. Maybe that's what's going on. Maybe it's the fact that rebellions were very unlikely to succeed. Now, slaves had probably more practical concerns about something that they could attain, ways to try to make the experience of slavery a little less painful and a little more pleasant. You know, many enslaved people wanted families, like anyone else. But obviously this was challenging in the context of slavery. You know, no doubt slave families existed, even though technically they were not allowed to marry unless they received special dispensation from slave owners. Occasionally, slave owners could use marriage and having kids as a concession for working really hard. Others figured out ways to squeeze even more works from their slaves based on this. You know, a famous figure in ancient Rome, Cato, he used to charge male slaves a fee each time they visited female slaves for sex. Even if marriages took place, how secure could they be? Clearly not a whole lot, considering that anybody could be sold at any time. Slaves could be loaned away, sometimes given away. Slaves were sometimes rented out to guests for sex. Families could be split when sold. Kids could be sold without their parents. Sometimes they could be sold in the same town where it was still possible to visit. Sometimes it would be sold really far away. Owners, needless to say, were not overly concerned about keeping families together. And even if they were, maybe you had a particularly nice slave owner who liked you, problem was that when they died, whatever stability you had created could be taken apart in a minute. Last thing I want to throw regarding slavery in the Roman world, and this again goes for slavery throughout much of history, is what exactly were slaves used for? Of course, work is the primary thing, using somebody else's energy for your own benefit. That's what the basic of slavery is all about. But also one of the big answers regarding what was slavery for in history is sex. You know, buying slaves either primarily for sex or at least as a secondary benefit was typical. You know, the more attractive the enslaved person, the more likely they were to bring big money. Slaves at the auction would have to appear naked and carry signs advertising their qualities. Rape, therefore, was the norm. Not necessarily violent rape, but I mean, how free of consent can you be if you're the enslaved person, you know? So in some sense, almost any kind of sexual relationship between slaves and slave owner could be construed as rape to one degree or another. You know, in many cases, slaves had to be somewhat fatalistic about catering to the sexual needs of the masters. You know, some people would use it as a weapon to try to get closer to the slave owners, to get treated better. There were, I'm sure, cases where genuine good feelings could develop, maybe even love. But the reality, of course, is that this was a skewed relationship where, you know, the two partners were not entering it on even ground. Now, did I say that this talk about sex in slavery was the last thing I would touch on before getting to the meat of our story and getting into the slave wars? Well, it turns out I lied. There's one more thing I want to mention. Resistance to slavery. Resistance to slavery was just because major rebellions didn't take place often does not mean that other forms of resistance didn't occur regularly. You know, the most typical kind of resistance of all slaves throughout history in many parts of the world is trying to cheat slave owners out of work and money whenever possible. Trying to get away with doing as little work as humanly possible. So in that sense, it becomes almost a context between the slave owner who's trying to squeeze as much labor out of the slaves and the slaves trying to get away with as little as possible. These kind of what in some cases the upper classes would perceive as laziness on the part of the slaves, it would also be a form of, you know, this idea of playing dumb is something that slaves did quite a bit. Murdering one's owners was probably not a typical thing done by slaves in the Roman world, particularly because there were some extremely harsh laws that if you were to kill a slave owner, horrible things could happen to you and every other slave in the household. We'll discuss that more later. But in any case, this was not something that happened typically. Trying to escape was also dangerous business. In many cases, slaves had to wear a collar with a tag, very much like dogs today. So there were instructions for returning fugitive slaves that, you know, anybody trying to escape would have to get rid of this collar in order not to be caught immediately. In the early imperial period, they will see the development of professional slave catchers who will chase escapees, you know, slaves that have run away. So in that sense, professional slave hunters will literally hunt them down. Later laws, you know, Roman law would eventually develop by arguing that they will develop some ideas regarding anybody hiding a runaway slave is to be considered a thief, and they themselves can suffer major punishments or even be enslaved. This was clearly to deter anybody from helping runaway slaves. And slave hunters or even soldiers sometimes were allowed to search any house for fugitive slaves. There were occasionally some, there were earlier revolts before the ones that were going to be discussed today. There was Livy, the Roman historian Livy mentioned one in 198, very close to Rome, in which the praetor Lucius Cornelius Merula killed 500 Carthaginian rebel slaves. There was one in Etruria, roughly modern-day Tuscany, 196, one in Apulia in 185. This latest one was probably a crackdown against the cult of Dionysus, which had been outlawed in the previous year. These are all things that I want to discuss later. I especially want to explore the connection between the god Dionysus and slave revolts. But we'll get to that later. Now, after this intro about slavery in the Roman world, I want to get to the first slave war, which took place. Historians are not exactly sure when it began. The year 135 before Common Era is the one that they usually settle for. Some people suggest a little bit earlier. We do know for sure that it ended by the year 132 before Common Era. So that's the time frame. And if we were to get a sense of what's ahead for us, what we're going to be looking at, the words of a Roman by the name of Orosius, writing in the 5th century Common Era, which was probably summarizing the work of the Roman historian Livy. It's saying, in a few words, it sums up the Roman attitude toward this war, what the memory of this war was. In Orosius' words, this war was both serious and savage. So, story is, something intense is about to happen. What we know about this war comes primarily from the work of the Greek historian Diodorus Siculus. Much of his work is gone. We have only fragments of it. However, quite a bit of it was summarized by other ancient historians who had read Diodorus, and we have their work. Guys like Photios and Constantine who wrote about it. So let's see what this first slave war was all about. This first slave war took place in the island of Sicily, which, for those of you guys who are geographically challenged, it's just off the coast of modern-day mainland Italy. Back in the day, it was considered the agricultural breadbasket for Rome. It was particularly important economically. Things had changed in the island of Sicily around a few decades prior to this. After the end of the Second Punic War, which was the second of three wars that Rome fought with its main rival, Carthage. After the Second Punic War, which was between 218 and 201 before Common Era, land speculators rushed in to buy cheap land that had been lost by Carthaginian supporters, who either were arrested or got kicked off the island or their land was confiscated. In any scenario, bottom line, they lost land, which meant that there was a whole lot of land available on the market, and land speculators rushed in to buy it at a cheap price. What they did with the land was not set up small farms for subsistence or for production for local consumption. What they did was to set up these huge estates with large-scale farming done on them, in order to produce for distant marketplaces, and just as a cash crop, just to make money that way. This meant that the demand for slavery increased dramatically, so at this time, there were probably more slaves in Sicily than there had ever been. The agricultural slaves on these huge estates would be, during the day, they would be working under close supervision, and at night, they would be locked up in these work barracks, which in Latin they were referred to as ergastula, which is an interesting concept because the term ergastolo still in modern-day Italian referred to a life sentence. So the fact that this was used to refer to the work barracks in which the slaves were kept in at night gives you an idea of how bad conditions were for slaves. In addition to the agricultural slaves, in Sicily as well as much of southern Italy, there was another type of slaves. These guys were those who took care of cattle, sheep, pigs, goats, all the kind of animals that would be raised on these farms, and they would be needed to be taken to pastures. So some of these slaves had considerably more freedom of movement compared to the agricultural slaves, and they were usually also much better armed, since they would have to protect the flocks against wild animals as well as bandits. A clue to the problem brewing on the island is offered in the primary sources. This is probably Diodorus Siculus as quoted by Photius, basically blaming the slave masters. I'm just going to go ahead and quote it, so you hear it from directly from the primary sources. The masters were arrogant and harsh in their treatment of the slaves. Since they were convinced that the slaves deserved only minimum care, they gave them the least possible food and clothing. Most of the slaves were forced to provide for their own livelihood by becoming bandits. The result was that every place in Sicily was filled with murder. What this quote is alluding to the experience of the herdsmen, those who were with the animals roaming the countryside, bringing them from one pasture to the next. And essentially what we get from this quote is the fact that the herdsmen were not really given many supplies by the slave owners. The slave owners were not overly concerned with their welfare. Their idea was, I don't want to know how you make a living, just stay alive, bring me back my animals, that's all I need to know. How you do that? Well, as long as it doesn't come from my pocket, I don't care how you get your livelihood. The herdsmen were already picked among the toughest fighting types of slaves because they had to be tough in order to protect the flocks from wild animals and bandits. Sometimes they would send also the toughest women with them as partners for the seasons. But essentially, other than that, they really wouldn't provide much food or clothing. And if anything, slave owners encouraged them to use violence to provide for themselves. So the result is that herdsmen would often attack traveling people, attack other estates to steal from them. They would pose a fearsome sight. These guys would dress in the hides of wolves and wild boars that they had hunted. They were probably scary looking to begin with, as these big, burly, strong types. On top of it, they were dressed up in the hides of wild animals. They usually had packs of dogs with them. So these were not the kind of guys that you wanted to meet in a dark road in the middle of Sicily at night. Here is another quote from the primary sources, giving you an idea of what was going on here. At first, they murdered men who happened to be traveling alone or in pairs along the roads in out-of-the-way places. Then they gathered in gangs to attack the houses of unprotected people during the night, taking by force all their possessions and killing all those who tried to resist them. Finally, their daring became greater and greater, with the result that at night no road in Sicily was safe anymore. So what the image that this quote paints for us is one that's quite scary. There's really no law enforcement. You have these tough guys providing as best as they can through violence for themselves, attacking travelers, attacking other estates, attacking, you know, at first easy targets with one or two travelers by themselves on the road, but then eventually even attacking houses and more protected places. Now, what should happen at this point is that in this kind of scenario where nobody feels safe, it would be the job of the governor of Sicily to do something about it, to raise a militia and crack down on these violent robberies. But he doesn't. Why he doesn't? It is another quote giving us a clue. The Roman governors of Sicily try to prevent the growth of these gangs, but he did not dare to punish them because of the power and the influence of the landowners who were the brigands' slave masters. The governors were forced to overlook the plundering of their own province. Most of the great landowners were Roman equites. Equites, by the way, is a Latin term that referred to, literally translated, means knights. They are really high up within the aristocracy of Roman society. They are not quite at the top level of the patricians. They are not quite among the super old, wealthy family, but they are just one step below. So you're talking about very powerful people. In any case, back to our quotes. Since these same landowners were also jurors in the cases against Roman governors, were arraigned on charges arising from the maladministration of their provinces, the men who served as governors greatly feared them. Now, some historians see something fishy in this quote because they believe that equites were not on jury until much later in history, so there may be a mistake in the primary sources, or maybe not. Maybe it's a mistake in the historian interpretation of what was going on. Maybe the equites were truly on the jury at this time, which is why the governors were scared of them. Or maybe they were not on the juries, but they still had something else, some kind of hold on Sicily's governors, because what we do know is that the governor did nothing about it, even though he was, as the quote indicates, seeing the plundering of his own province. He was forced to look away when this was happening. Why would he do that? Again, it's only in the case where these landowners had something on them, whether it's the fear that they could later prosecute them and serve on the jury, or maybe through bribes or some other kind of hold. But definitely the result is that the governor was doing their bidding by not cracking down on these slave gangs. So this is the context. This is the dry tinder just waiting for a spark that will light up the island of Sicily. The place where our drama will originate is the city of Enna. Enna was known as the navel of Sicily because it was right smack in the center of the island. It was surrounded by the richest agricultural plains, and it was also a center of religious worship, specifically of the goddess Demeter, who was Ceres in Latin. She was the goddess of the harvest. She was a central figure, along with her daughter Persephone, of the Eleusinian mysteries in ancient Greece. Often she was worshipped alongside with Dionysus. In any case, bottom line, Enna was an important place, both because of its economic importance, because its geographic location, because of its religious importance. Now for a second we move away from speaking in general terms about slave owners and slaves, and we actually get to name people. Specifically, the first character that we're going to deal with right now was a man from Enna by the name of Antigenes. Antigenes was a slave owner who owned a Syrian slave by the name, I've heard it pronounced several different ways, whether Eunus, Eunus, depending on whether you emphasize a more ancient Latin pronunciation, a more anglicized one. Take your pick. I'm just going to try to stick with one, but there are several ways in which it can be pronounced. In any case, Eunus was the Syrian slave who was famous for being both a magician, an expert in this sleight of hand type of tricks, as well as what in the ancient world they referred to as a wonder worker, a prophet, an oracle. Now, in the ancient world, the dividing line between somebody who's a trickster, who's an expert in sleight of hand tricks, and somebody who actually is a prophet, somebody who has religious importance, was not quite as sharp as we would think of today. Today we don't think of a religious leader in the same way as we think of some magician putting on a show in Vegas or something. Back then, the boundary was considerably thinner between the two. So Eunus claimed that the gods spoke to him. He claimed that the gods spoke through him. And in a few cases, his predictions actually did come true. So he started gaining popularity as more and more people, particularly slaves, began to think that maybe the gods truly whisper in his ears. He was a devotee of the Syrian goddess Atargatis, was the same as Astarte, probably the same as the biblical Asherah. She was a fertility goddess. And ultimately, many scholars believe that in the ancient Mediterranean world, people tend to merge many of their goddesses in sort of a generic great mother goddess. So some of these names are somewhat interchangeable. Quite a few historians believe that he was really the same goddess worshipped under different names with slightly different attributes by in different regions. So even Demeter was mixed in with the same Atargatis, Astarte, Asherah, however you want to call her. In any case, regardless of which specific goddess he was a devotee of, regardless of all of that stuff, let's take a look at the primary sources for what Yunus actually did. His most striking performance was this. While in a state of ecstatic possession, he was able, by the use of some device, to produce fire and to breathe flames from his mouth. While in a trance, he would utter more prophecies about the things to come. One of the wildest of the prophecies that he started telling people about was the notion that he said, one day the goddess told me that I'm gonna become king. Now remember, this is a slave saying this. So any sane person would look at this and think either this guy has lost his mind, or as his master did, they would take it as a big joke. They thought it was funny. So his master would often bring out Yunus and parade him at the banquets that he gives for his other noble friends, so that the nobles could just laugh at him. They would, they would bring him out, let him put on his show, breathing fire, doing magic tricks, being a good entertainer. And then they would humor him. They would start asking him questions about how he would treat them when he became king. Some of them would act as if they were trying to get in his good graces by giving him choice food as a reward for any entertainment, and they would also have a big laugh and ask, are you going to remember about my generosity once you're going to be king? And then they would all crack up, drink some more wine, and just not think much of it anymore. Well, little did they know, they actually saved their lives in that way. Since, as it turns out, Yunus would very much remember the faces and names of those who had been kind to him in those occasions. Now, other characters enter our story. In Enna, there was a man by the name of Damophilos. By the way, you see from these names the heavy Greek influence. Damophilos is an obviously very Greek name. This is because the island of Sicily had been a Greek colony for an extremely long time, long before becoming a Roman province. So some of the culture, some of the names were still, there was still a strong Greek influence. So this guy by the name of Damophilos, he was a slave owner who treated his slaves particularly badly. His wife, by the name of Megalles, another obviously Greek name, was just as mean, just as sadistic. So their slaves began plotting against them. Now, normally most slaves would think twice about plotting against the slave owners, because horrible things would be done if they were caught doing something against their slave masters. But these particular people felt that their life was so horrible, that they were being abused so badly, that they really had nothing to lose. The life couldn't get much worse, so it was worth taking a chance. Now, there have been quite a few rebellions, smaller rebellions in the Roman world, but regularly you hear stories about slaves trying to rebel, getting captured, getting crucified, or meeting equally horrible deaths. So it really wasn't, rebellion didn't sound like a very good deal. There was an actual Roman law stated that if a slave killed the master, every single slave in the household would be executed. There was a famous case once of a master being killed by one of his slaves, and 400 slaves in that particular household all being led to execution. These included women, kids, old people, bunch of people who knew nothing about the killing, who did not participate, did not support it. And so there were quite a few protests, even among free Romans, against what they perceived to be a particularly cruel application of the law. But yet the people who defended this decision and ultimately went through with the killing of these 400 slaves stated that unless they did this, no master in Rome would be safe. Why is that? Because in doing this, in letting slaves know that if anyone killed their master, their neck would be on the line, they basically tied the slave's own self-interest to the welfare of the master. You know, if you heard that some other slave in your estate was planning to kill the master, you probably wanted to stop them. Because if they were, unless you would be able to escape with them, then your neck would be on the line just as much as the neck of the guy who had done the killing. You would meet an equally horrible end. So this law was an insurance policy for slave masters by suggesting to slaves that it really was not in their best interest to turn the other way or keep quiet if they heard of any kind of conspiracy aimed at the life of their slave master. So the fact that these guys, Damophilos' slaves, were ready to rise up meant that they would have to, all together, they would have to be convinced. If one person was not convinced, they would run back and whisper to the slave owner, hey, there's this plan, these guys are planning to kill you, in hoping A, for a reward, and B, not to get killed if their master was killed in the first place. But this was not the scenario that we're looking at here. Here, probably every one of the slaves owned by Damophilos and Megalis were in on the plot to get rid of them. Back to the primary sources. All of them donned the most powerful weapon of all, a rage that was directed at the destruction of their arrogant and overbearing masters. So these guys have had it. They want to kill them. But before taking the plunge, before taking this daring step, they go to Yunus to ask, what does the goddess have to say about this? Does the goddess approve? Is she okay with us going ahead and getting rid of our masters? And Yunus did his show, went into a trance and said that the gods were very much with them. He said, yes, go ahead. The gods give the thumbs up. So here we have about 400 slaves, most of them from Damophilos and Megalis, a few other from other farms, who got together, swore oaths to each other, of loyalty, of that they were all going to stick to this plan, perform religious sacrifices. This is interesting right there. You're planning a slave uprising, and one of the first things you do is pray. That's kind of, I mean, in a way it makes sense, because they are doing something very scary and very daring, and they do want to have the gods on their side. But it's interesting considering what they're about to do. So at this point, after performing the proper sacrifices, they grab whatever tool could be turned into a weapon, and they ask Yunus to lead them. And here we have these 400 slaves entering Enna in the middle of the night, weapons in hand, ready to kill as many slave masters as possible. Other slaves start joining them, so this stops being something against one particular set of slave masters. It starts extending to several others. The slaves rush into Enna. In the first line, ahead of everybody else, you have Yunus leading the charge, breathing fire. Now picture that. You are a noble Roman, and you hear some kind of commotion down the street. You open your windows to take a peek, and what you see are 400 angry slaves led by a fire-breathing Syrian. I mean, this is a scene straight out of your worst nightmares. Here you have your image of what probably demons bursting out of hell look like, who are coming for your life. Back to the primary sources. Breaking into the houses in the city, the rebel slaves institute a general slaughter, not even sparing the suckling infants among the inhabitants. Tearing them from their mother's breast, they dash the infants to the ground. One cannot actually say in words what they did to the women themselves, and with their husbands looking on, what terrible acts of outrage and utter lewdness were committed on them. Here we have slaves from many different estates joining together and beginning to kill their masters. Even some free people, people who were not slaves at all, but they were clearly among the poorest of the poor, in Roman society, joined with the slaves and began to attack the wealthier people in town. You know, sometime you hear these days people talk about class warfare. Well, this is class warfare right here. Slaves and extremely poor people just unleashing hell on the wealthier citizens in town. Now, the primary targets of this whole thing, the same Damophilus and Megales whose slaves had started this rebellion, they couldn't be found. As it turns out, they were in luck because they were not in Enna at the moment. They were at a villa outside of town. So some of the slaves, once they realized they are not here, they took off and went to get them at their villa. They captured them, they brought them back, and by this point they had taken control of the town, so they brought Damophilus and his wife in the theater where all the slaves were assembled, and they put them on trial. As it turns out, Damophilus was a really good public speaker, so he began defending himself with great eloquence. And a few slaves were getting worried that this guy was so good, he was so persuasive, that, what if he actually convinces some of the other slaves to spare him? This would be really bad news. I can almost hear, you know, when I picture Damophilus in the middle of the amphitheater giving his speech, trying to convince everybody that it's all a big mistake, that he's not a bad guy and all of it, I can almost hear some of his slaves in Bruce Campbell voice. If you have watched Army of Darkness, you know what I'm talking about. I can almost hear Bruce Campbell's voice whispering in the ears of some of Damophilus' slaves, "It's a trick, get an axe," which is one of the greatest lines in movie making. Because as it turns out, this is exactly what happened. A couple of Damophilus' slaves begin to worry about Damophilus' persuading abilities, and they decide to put an end to it right here, right now. So they do not wait for the outcome. They don't want to find out what the other slave thinks. They decide to take matters in their own hands. And so two of these guys, as the primary sources say, the one man drove his sword through Damophilus' chest, while the other cut his throat with an axe. Well, that takes care of business right there. Now, one of the men who had just killed Damophilus decided to turn his attention to Damophilus' daughter, who was a teenager at this time. Now, considering that what just happened is a wholesale series of massacres and rape on a wide scale, you would expect that the fate of Damophilus' daughter cannot be a happy one at this point. But as it turns out, history sometimes is more complicated than we may expect. Damophilus' daughter, unlike her parents, she had been extremely sweet to the slaves. Everybody agreed that she was always kind toward them. She tried to help them and make things easier for them. So now they decide to take care of her. And this is where it gets weird. Here you have a man who just finished chopping her father's head off, and he turns to the daughter and shows nothing but kindness in return for her kindness that she had shown earlier. Primary sources again. Because of her kindness, she was greatly loved by everyone. So it happened in the present circumstances that her previous favors provoked in response the sympathy of those who had been treated well by her. Not only did no slave dare violently and shamefully to lay hands on the girl, but all of them made sure that the flower of her beauty was kept free from any outrage against her honor. Instead, the slaves selected the best men from their own numbers. The most outstanding among them was a man named Hermias, and had them escort her safely to the home of some of her relatives in the city of Catana. So here you have these guys who are probably covered in blood from the massacre that has just taken place, and some of them are not exactly the most noble characters ever. After all, they have just finished doing raping and horrible things to some of the other citizens. But apparently they are not indiscriminating in their violence, because people who have been particularly kind to her, they make sure to protect them. Here, this girl got to be, not only she doesn't get raped, but they all kind of gather around her, protect her from anybody doing anything to her, and they take her to the safety of relatives in a city further away. This is what prompts the primary sources here to, again, quote, "From this action of theirs, it is shown that the violence of the slaves did not stem from an innate disposition toward others, but rather that their actions were only fair repayment for the injustices that had formerly been inflicted on them." In other words, the primary sources, in no ambiguous terms, place the blame on the slave owners. They argue that this violent reaction was just karma for what they had done to the slaves up until minutes before. Now, still in the theater, the mass of the now former slaves proclaim Yunus as their king. So it turns out his prophecy was true. He would become a king. Megalis, the female slave owner, was renowned for her sadism, was handed over to the female slaves to do as they wish with her. And what they wish with her, turns out, was torturing her and throwing her off a cliff. Here you have a historian by the name of Posidonius about Damophilos and his wife Megalis. He comments, "They met their end in a suitably humiliating manner, the object of their own slaves' contempt." Eunice now begins to order a few executions. He pulls out his hit list and he orders the execution of several more slave owners, sparing only those who were good at making weapons and those who had shown him sympathy at the banquets. Remember the story about him going around and everybody laughing at him, thinking he was a big joker and giving him food and say, "Please remember me when you become king." Now he is king and he does remember, and he shows them favor and he actually has them spared. Eunice had a girlfriend and he names her his queen. He begins to wear purple, as the purple was the color of royalty in the Mediterranean world, and quickly manages to arm over 6,000 men. So the numbers, the ranks of the slaves are swelling by the minute. They begin to attack properties around Enna and expand the territory under their control very rapidly. Words among Roman authorities in other parts of the island is that something has to be done. They begin hearing reports of what's going on, so they start sending commanders against Yunus. They start sending forces. The reaction by the Romans too is very slow. Initially, they underestimate what's going on. And what's going to happen for the next few months is that the reality is that no major military leader, or soldiers for that matter, wanted to fight slaves. There was no honor in beating a slave army, and there was no money to be made, because the ancient armies at this time, they would fight for plunder. Now, if you beat a bunch of slaves, there's really not much plunder to be taken. So, you know, you don't win a glorious victory because you have beaten slaves, you're supposed to beat them, and you don't win any money. So not too many people were volunteering for this kind of assignment. What typically happened in a lot of these slave rebellions is that initially they are confronted with just a weak local militia who gets beaten. Same thing is going to happen in this case. Eunice by now is enjoying his success and beginning to have fun with this being king of Sicily idea. He has, as I mentioned, he has nominated his woman as his queen. He has organized a group of guys who serve as his council of advisors. He's even beginning to create his own coins, having the coins minted with the face of the goddess Demeter on one side and his own name on the other. You know, basically creating the symbol of an independent state, because that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to carve out a separate independent state, expanding slowly but surely throughout Sicily. So while he's having fun, he receives some news that are actually very good news. He finds out that just 1 month after his initial rebellion, a second revolt has broken out just a few miles away in the south, led by a guy by the name of Cleon and his brother Comas, or Comanos, depending on the primary sources, differ on the guy's name. They were also slaves, they were horse herders, and they were also famous as bandits on the side, as many of the slaves were acting as herders were, as we mentioned earlier. Very quickly, Cleon and Comas were able to organize a group of 5,000 slaves to revolt. They had been inspired by hearing of the success of Yunus' revolt, so they got their guys together and, in an amazing feat, captured the city of Agrigentum. All of this is beginning to happen very quickly, and, you know, the Romans are not quite ready to deal with this. This is happening too fast for them to react. Really, when they hear about these two separate revolts, most of the Romans are just hoping that the two groups would begin to fight each other. But instead, bad luck for the Romans, they make an alliance. Cleon just accepts to be Eunus' second in command and put all of his men at Eunus' disposal to do as he wishes with. So far from the two revolts canceling each other, they actually unite in one big slave army. And by now they are capturing one Roman city after another. They capture Enna to start with. They now capture, I'm going to use the modern Italian names for some of these cities. So Agrigento, Taormina, Catania, some of the big cities that to this day are quite important in Sicily. They all start falling into the hands of this rebel army. At the height of the revolt, it's estimated that they probably controlled maybe as much as half of the whole island of Sicily. That's a lot of land in a short period of time. So the Romans realize they have to get serious, and they send a praetor. It's a particularly important office in the Roman hierarchy, just a little bit below the consul, which was pretty much as high as you could go. A praetor by the name of Lucius Ipseus. He arrived from Rome and took control of about 8,000 soldiers who were recruited in Sicily. And you figure, you know, a Roman army with 8,000 soldiers is serious business. Problem was that by now the slave army had grown to over 20,000. So being outnumbered by more than 2-to-1, the praetor met a sorry end, his army was crushed, and this victory boosted the morale of the slave army, who now had their first real test in facing a Roman army, and they passed it with flying colors. So by the next year, the Romans get even a little more serious. They send one of the two consuls for the year 134, a guy by the name of Fulvius Flaccus. He arrives, raising a consular army, so really pretty much as high as you could go in the Roman hierarchy. He brings his guys, and he still meet very little success. Now, we don't really know much about what happens, because the primary sources are largely silent on the details. They just say that Fulvius Flaccus met with no success when he tried to invade the island. Well, when news of this spread, when the realization that Rome is being unable to stop the slave rebellion start trickling into the brains of lots of people in Italy and in some of the other Roman provinces, many other slaves decide, why not take a chance? So there are quite a few small-scale rebellions all over Italy. There was even one with only 150 slaves, but still, in the heart of Rome. Now, all of these rebellions were squashed quickly. None of them met the success that the slaves were able to achieve in Sicily. But nonetheless, these are all signs that make some people in Rome worry. They feel that unless they are able to squash the Sicilian rebellion, this will stick out as a sore thumb and as a reminder and an inspiration for enslaved people in other parts of the Roman world that maybe you could challenge Rome and win. And that's exactly what the slaves in Sicily are doing. Well, I keep saying slaves, but now they are former slaves. The Romans still think of them as slaves. These men clearly do not think the same. They think of themselves as free men. Now, in the year 133, the Romans try again. Let's send a new consul out with a new army. They send this guy by the name of Calpurnius Piso. He was one of the consuls for 133. And again, primary sources don't give us a whole lot of details regarding what happens. The only thing we understand is that Piso was slightly more successful than his predecessors in this job, but clearly not successful enough as to crush the resistance. So the odds are he probably scored a few victories, unlike the commanders before him, but nothing dramatic enough to alter the course of what was going on in Sicily. This job will be reserved for the next consul, the third consul by now, to try this job, one of the consuls for the year 132, by the name of Rupilius. Rupilius is now the third one after Fulvius Flaccus, after Piso, sent to Sicily trying to deal with this. Third year in a row, and this time, third time is a charm for the Roman armies, Rupilius meets with more success than Flaccus, than Piso, than anybody who had tried to deal with this rebellion. Specifically, he first lays siege to the town of, in modern Italian terms, they refer to it as Taormina. Taormina meets a really sorry end. The Roman army there is extremely skilled at building a very tight siege that none of the slaves are able to escape. They are not able to get any shipments of food. They are completely cut off. And Rupilius does not try to storm the town, does not try to waste the lives of his men in major attacks against the city walls, because you know that's next to impossible to achieve. He's content just slowly waiting for the slaves in South Taormina to starve. And starve they do, as the primary sources tell us. Before you know it, the people inside Taormina, they start starving so bad that, I quote, "They began first with their own children, and then their women. Finally, in despair, they did not even shrink from devouring each other." Now, these are two sentences in the primary sources. "They began first with their own children, and then their women. Finally, in despair, they did not even shrink from devouring each other." Now, the primary sources are so stingy with details on this. They only give us these two lines regarding the siege and what happens. But what they don't tell us is what tickles the mind, you know, what makes you think about... I mean, think about yourself. What would it take for you to drive you to the point where you end up eating your kids and your wife? How starved do you have to be to decide that your children are on the menu now? I mean, probably any one of us would say, "Oh, I would never do that. Come on, I would rather die than eat my kids or eat my wife. Or what the hell? This is terrible. This is horrible stuff. Who in their right mind would ever do that?" Well, that's probably true. Maybe you wouldn't. But then again, when was the last time you went for weeks with hardly any food and you were beyond despair? Whatever happens in Taormina during those weeks must have been so ugly and so nasty as to seriously test the human capacity for kindness, compassion, or even mental sanity. This, to me, is what makes history interesting sometimes, is to try to put yourself in the shoes of some of the historical actors on the scene, because these were all real people. They were thousands and thousands of people involved. So some of them, I'm sure, they were probably as far from you in terms of priority, mentality, attitude as you can think. Some of may have not been that far. Some of these people, you could probably sit down at a table today and have some level of understanding, because they are human after all. They still, some of, as much as culture and time frame can influence us, and different cultures produce radically different human beings, at the root of it all, we're still talking about human beings 2,000 years ago, not a different species, not something completely remote and foreign. So to me, it's interesting to try to relate. In this case, it's not particularly fun to try to relate because the condition we are looking at is as ugly ever got. In any case, cutting down on the speculations, the consul Rupilius not only is able to start inducing the people inside the Taormina to begin eating each other. But on top of it, he's able to capture one of the big leaders of this rebellion. This is Cleon's brother, Comas, who, along with Cleon, had started the second rebellion. And in one of the primary sources, tell us that after Comas was captured, they tried to interrogate him. And here is the primary sources very much defy logic or our understanding of human physiology, because what they say is that Comas just refused to give them any information, and he simply stopped breathing, and through sheer willpower made himself die by holding his breath. Which anybody who has ever tried, that's not gonna work. Sorry, that's if that's high up on your suicide list, I'm glad to tell you that you're not gonna kill yourself that way. That's just not gonna happen. Who knows exactly what happens? Bottom line, they don't get what they want out of Comas, and he dies in Roman hands rather than give up any secrets. He might as well have been giving up secrets, because somebody else does. There was a Syrian man on the side of the slaves who betrayed the citadel and allowed the Romans to come in and capture up all the survivors remaining in the city. Rupilius decided to promptly torture some of the slaves that had been in the city and eventually had thrown them off a cliff. Now, the torture part seemed a bit redundant. These, after all, are people who just hate their own kids and women. Really, you need to torture them? What else can you do to them? I mean, isn't it? But in any case, Rome is Rome, and they have to make a point. So torturing them and throwing them off the cliff is the way to do it. Fresh of this success, Rupilius at this point turns his attention to Enna, the main city where the rebellion had started, where some of the most important members of the slave army are still located. Cleon, the leader of the second rebellion, he emerged from the city with some of his men and gave open battle outside the city walls against the Roman army. Accounts tell that he fought heroically, but nonetheless, heroically doesn't mean successfully, and so he was killed in battle. So Cleon, one of the major leaders of this whole thing, is out of the picture. Much like it had happened at Taormina, at Enna as well, somebody inside the city wall will betray the city to the Romans. This does not take much to figure out why it would happen. You know, obviously, if you see the writing on the wall that Rome is beginning to win, you hedge your bets and decide, do I want to stay on the side that looks like they're losing now, or can I make a separate deal that will allow me to keep my head on my shoulders, not get tortured to death, and end up being on the winning side? This is exactly what had happened at Taormina. This is exactly what happens at Enna. Somebody from the inside make a deal with the Romans, open up the gates. The Romans come in, storm the city. Eunus realized that now is no longer fun to be the king, because all the Romans are searching for him everywhere. With a group of men, about 1,000 of them, they try to flee. But once they realize that Roman soldiers are hot on their trail and they're about to catch them, 1,000 of his men decide to just cut each other's throats rather than fall into Roman hands. Eunus, however, does not take the same road. He does not try to kill himself or have somebody else kill him. The story goes that he tried to hide in a cave, but he was found. And this, again, is where the primary sources get a bit weird, because the tale is that he died before they could punish him of, I quote, a lice-consuming disease. What exactly is a lice-consuming disease? This could be a generic term for some kind of wasting disease. This could be, it's hard to tell what, this could entirely be a made-up story by Roman chroniclers who wanted to come up with something horrendously disgusting for Eunus' death and made it up. I mean, the odds that they would let him live long enough to die of whatever disease he was dealing with seem really small. I mean, after all, they do horrible things, and you know, the few guys who had not killed each other were still with Eunus, were crucified. So the odds that nothing was done to him and he actually did die of natural causes seem really small. But then again, that's the primary sources we're working with. So in either case, he also is not going to live long after the end of this rebellion. This is the end of the first, what the Romans refer to as a servile war, as a slave war. This is how it ends. You know, noble attempt while he went. You know, they had quite a bit of success for at least 3 years, possibly more. But by 132, the whole game was over. The Romans had taken control of Sicily yet again. Now, this war left a big impression in the minds of many Romans. Around this time, as the fighting was taking place, one of the great famous Roman reformers, Tiberius Gracchus, addressed the Sicilian issue in order to emphasize his agrarian reforms. Tiberius Gracchus at this time was trying to make sure that there would be land redistribution, so there would be many more freeborn Roman citizens who would be small-scale farmers. He was critical of the large-scale agriculture in the hands of few people becoming majorly wealthy thanks to this. He argued that the system of slavery that was at the roots of the Sicilian rebellion was a problematic one. He wasn't saying no more slavery. He wasn't that radical, but he was radical in the sense that he wanted slavery to play a smaller role in the Roman world, and he wanted instead to have more Italian families being able to control their own plot of land, farm their land for their own subsistence. Tiberius Gracchus was trying to push all of these, and so the Sicilian war was perfect for him as an example of, you see, if we don't do what I'm telling you, what can happen? He wasn't the only one to use the Sicilian examples among famous figures in ancient Rome. An equally powerful and famous figure was Cicero. Cicero, politician, lawyer, one of the key figures in the latter days of the Roman Republic. During one of the trials in which he stood as a prosecutor, when he was prosecuting this guy by the name of Gaius Verres, who was a former Roman governor in Sicily, he was prosecuting him for extortion. He used the example of the slave rebels really just to slander Verres. He was saying how the behavior of the slave rebels that we all know to be so awful and terrible was actually better than what Gaius Verres did to Sicily. You know, he's engaging in overblown hyperbole. He's just trying to use the slave war as ammunition for his own slandering of Verres. But nonetheless, the fact that the Sicilian War was used by key figures of this period of the Roman Republic is a reminder of how powerful of a story it was. It was something that you couldn't ignore if you lived in Rome at the time. Sicily wasn't that far removed, and the understanding that this was a big deal and it had to be stopped was certainly in the minds of most Roman citizens of this time. Now, for about 30 years after these events, things, from a Roman standpoint, things look good in Sicily. They are, you know, they have regained control of the whole province, they are setting things up again, they are returning properties to their legitimate owner, or again, depending on what you consider legitimate, what in ancient Rome was considered the legitimate owners. So life is going back to normal. But this issue of slaves rebelling in huge numbers with surprising success does not end with this one war in Sicily. Because about 30 years later, slightly less than 30 years later, actually in 104 before Common Era and lasting until the year 100 before Common Era, war number two will be on the horizon. The second servile war is coming up. The reason why a second slave war will take place is because the root causes that have caused the first slave war had not really been addressed. This dramatic expansion of slavery and this shrinking of freeborn Italian citizens who could own their land and farm for their own subsistence was still ongoing. The Gracchi brothers had tried to push some land reforms to stop this process and, you know, improve conditions for some of the poorest of the poor in Roman society. But the response by the aristocracy, and I say it by the aristocracy, but this is funny too, because the Gracchi brothers were some of the big aristocratic families in Rome. This was a clash between aristocratic people who believed that one should reform things in favor of the poor because it would keep the whole system more stable, and aristocratic people who felt, screw the poor, we need to do things as we have always done them, let's maximize the profits for us, and they were not too keen on changing things in a way that will limit their own profits. So in any case, the Gracchi brothers, who had championed this idea of land reform and taking up the cause of the poorer citizens, were both killed by the other factions. So the response that the Roman aristocracy of this time had given to people who were saying, hey, maybe we should do something about it, maybe we should address this issue, was to silence them, was to use violence to kill both of them. This happened during the year, in decades of the 130s and 120s. So not surprisingly, since nothing really was done to change the situation, the same problems will flare up again. You know, there were a few minor slave rebellions that were squashed. There was one in Campania that led to a crucifixion of some 400 plus slaves. There was another one in Sinuessa. There was a small one even in Rome. All of these three rebellions were squashed quickly. There was a more substantial one that started around Capua, which is modern-day Campania, you know, relatively close to Naples. Here a man by the name of Titus Minucius Vettius was a member of the Roman aristocracy. He was an equus. He was what can be translated as a knight, which, as we had said before, was just one step below the highest class in Rome. So these are people who were, may have not been one of the few super powerful families, but these were, you know, the knights were people who had plenty of money, plenty of political power. And yet, this particular rebellion will start from this guy. It will be a slave rebellion, so it's kind of bizarre, because here you have some really high-up man who will become the leader of a slave rebellion. How could this happen? Why? The reason is kind of funny, if you think about it. Here is what happened. Vettius had fallen in love with a slave girl. She was apparently incredibly beautiful. Vettius was quite fond of her. Problem was, this woman was owned by another man. And, you know, one of the basic laws, anytime you want something, if you show that you want it really badly, then the other person knows that they can charge you as much as humanly possible. It's one of the things, the least you want something, the best bargain you can get, the more you show you want it, the less likely you are to get a good bargain. Well, Vettius was not a good poker player, because he showed his cards, he made it very clear that he was head over heels in love with this girl, and he wanted her. So the man who owned her was not going to sell her for cheap. He gave Vettius a taste. You know, Vettius had a chance to have sex with her, he had got to hang out with her, but the owner was not going to sell her. After enough pushing, he said, sure, I will sell her. And he demanded a selling price that was about 70 to 80 times the normal price for a slave. Vettius didn't have the money. He said, oh, don't worry, I'm going to come up with it. He was so crazy for her that he's like, he didn't want to take no for an answer. So he basically borrowed money from various sources to try to buy this girl. He got her, but now he had creditors knocking on his door. He had to come up with the money to pay back everybody and all of it. So he decided, forget it, this is not going to happen, I can't do it. He decided instead to buy hundreds of sets of armor and weapons for his slave. He had over 400 slaves under him. He decided to arm the slaves and incite them to rebellion. He promptly went out and they killed the owners of the woman he was in love with. He killed all the people that he owed money to. And he decided to appoint himself as king of Campania. Campania was the region around Capua. He began to attack the countryside and try to take control of as much land as possible. It's likely that all of Vettius' ancestors were now turning in their graves, thinking, I cannot believe you can be such an idiot, throwing away our good family name, our success, our property, in this misguided rebellion against the power of Rome. What are you calling yourself? You want to be king of Campania? Are you crazy? And over what? Over one woman you fell in love with? There are lots of women. Get over it. Well, Vettius did not get over it. He took his role very seriously as king of Campania. And Rome decided to take this very seriously, because they were not going to have something relatively close to the city. You know, we're only talking about little over 100 miles, having somebody trying to claim an independent kingdom. So they sent a praetor by the name of Lucius Licinius Lucullus. Lucullus went after Vettius with an army of 4,000 infantrymen and 400 cavalry. In the meantime, Vettius had also built a sizable army. He had by now about 3,500 men under his command. Lucullus tried to attack Vettius' army and failed initially because Vettius had set all of his men up on a high hill. So basic rule of military combat is you do not attack uphill. It rarely works out incredibly well. Definitely rarely works out incredibly well before artillery made the job slightly easier. So Lucullus is failing this attack. He gets pushed away. So he decided to try a different approach. If straight force doesn't do it, maybe a more devious way can get the job done. So rather than charging headlong and try again, he decided instead to make a deal with one of Vettius' generals. We don't get to find out exactly how the communication took place. Probably there's men sent undercover back and forth between the two camps. Bottom line, he gets one of Vettius' generals to make a deal with him. He promised immunity and promised a bribe. You know, not only you're not going to die, I'm going to spare your life, and I'm giving you a good chunk of money. So come on our side. Now, this particular general under Vettius must have been thinking and edging his bets and thinking, I don't think that the odds that Vettius is going to become truly king of Campania are that high. I'm beginning to think that maybe I beat more than I can chew. I better side with Rome instead. So he betrays access to his own men in a way that will allow Lucullus to, you know, essentially start up an internal fight among the slave army, which would make it very easy to Lucullus' army to come in and wipe them out. Vettius himself is killed along with many of his men, and this whole big rebellion is squashed. Now, despite the fact that this was actually a fairly big event, you know, we're dealing with two armies, one 3,500 men, the other one about 4,400. This is a big battle. This is not just a little slave rebellion, but this does not get to be counted among the three servile wars. This is a side note. However, it's an important side note because it shows you that this kind of thing was bound, that it kept happening over and over again. And right in the same year in which this fighting was breaking out in Campania, and when this actually all happened in the same year, the rebellion begins, the rebellion is squashed. But right at the same time, a bigger slave rebellion will break out. This will be considered the second servile war, the second slave war. And this is the second one to break out in Sicily. This will be between the year 104, when it begins, and it will end by the year 100 before Common Era. Okay, so 104 before Common Era to 100 before Common Era. And it's going to sound like almost a carbon copy of the first in many, many details. Much like during the first slave war, here we'll also have a double rebellion with two separate leaders who are going to join forces. Much like in the first slave wars, during the second one, there will be an initially slow response by the Romans. The militias raised against this slave rebellion will fail.
but eventually the outcome will be the same in the end. The main difference here is the causes. The historical context has much to do with it. What had just happened around this time was that the great general Gaius Marius had just defeated Jugurtha in North Africa and was now called to deal with a serious existential threat to Rome. Some nations from Northern Europe, previously unknown by the Romans, specifically the Cimbri and the Teutones, were showing up on the scene, and just across the border from Italy had started crushing Roman armies in what was considered Gaul at that time, and were making their way into Italy, defeating one Roman army after another. The Romans were panicking at this time. They were seriously thinking that the Cimbri and the Teutones had a shot at destroying Roman power throughout Italy. So they badly needed manpower to oppose these armies coming their way. And in an effort to raise men for the army, they started going to all of their allies, pressuring them to provide troops to fight what the Romans considered these barbarian nations. Problem is that in a few places, an issue came up during this recruitment effort. In one place, for example, in Bithynia, the king of Bithynia, a man by the name of Nicomedes, he protested that so many of his men had been kidnapped and sold into slavery by Roman tax collectors, because so many people had not been able to pay the crazy high taxes that Roman tax collectors expected. So the king of Bithynia said, "I would love to help you, except that big chunk of the youth of my country has been sold into slavery by tax collectors, so sorry, but I really cannot send you too many men." Some of Rome's Italian allies had similar complaints. Here as well, overly greedy Roman tax collectors charging impossibly high taxes had forced many people into slavery when they were not able to pay these taxes. So again, many of the Italian allies, much like what had happened with Nicomedes, king of Bithynia, refused to send anybody unless something was done about the situation. Now, at any other time, the Roman Senate may have refused to listen to them. At any other time, they could have done something else. But this is not any other time. The Cimbri and the Teutones are not waiting for Rome to slowly figure out what to do about it. Rome need to send a powerful army up north. So they take drastic measure. They say that free citizens from allied states should be freed if they were found in slavery at this time. They basically decide to free many of these people who have been brought into slavery because they were not able to pay taxes if they came from some of Rome's allied state, in an effort to pressure Rome's allies to start sending men into the army. So many of the men held in Sicily in slavery expected freedom. And the governor of Sicily, a man by the name of Licinius Nerva, began holding hearings and freeing some slaves. He started checking on who did you say you are. He would start checking people's name, checking where they came from, why they ended up being in slavery, and if he realized that they fit the profile of the people that the Senate just said should be freed, then he would free them. So after he started freeing a few people, the rumor starts spreading that this is happening, and more enslaved people expect that the same is going to happen to them. They are going to get their freedom. But something happened to stop Nerva's effort to free these people in compliance with the Senate orders. Specifically, the Sicilian slave owners, who had so much power in the island, started putting pressure on Nerva to stop the proceeding. Maybe they bribed him, at least that's the rumor, and no longer free any more slaves. We turn to the primary sources for this. They say, whether persuaded by their money or enslaved by their patronage, Nerva showed no more interest in his judicial hearings. So again, even the primary sources don't know for sure whether it was a bribe or there was another reason, but they noticed the fact that Nerva's abrupt turnaround and shutting down of this process that he had started seemed to indicate that pressure was being applied to him. Now, problem is that there are many slaves who are waiting to have their petitions heard, and now they are told to go back to their owners. They are both at this point mad and afraid. They are mad because they were thinking they had a legitimate shot at being freed, and they are afraid of the repercussions that now that they try to gain their freedom, that maybe their slave owners were not going to treat them all that well. So quite a few of them decided to flee from Syracuse, where they had gathered, to a religious shrine a little over 50 miles away, where at the shrine it was a sacred shrine where slaves could go there, and if they were found by the shrine, the law stated that it could not be dragged away against their will. It was a kind of a safe zone for slaves. So a whole lot of them gathered there, and they decided to rebel. They decided that Rome did not keep their end of the bargain. They did not hold the hearings as they were supposed to, or rather they did, but for way too short of a time. And so it was time to do something about it, and the timing was favorable. After all of Rome's manpower was being sent north to deal with the threat posed by the Cimbri and the Teutones. So there was really nobody left to deal with a possible slave rebellion. Hence, this is a good time to have a slave rebellion. The first micro-rebellion begins at a place called Alicia. There, some 30 slaves, led by a certain Varius, decided that it was a good time to cut their owners' throats in their sleep and try to make a break for it. They rushed to nearby farms and recruited other slaves, and slowly but surely they were adding numbers, and there were about 200 slaves in the space of a few hours that had started joining the rebellion. The governor Nerva convinced Gaius Titinius to help. Gaius Titinius was a rather unsavory character who a couple of years earlier had been condemned to death for various crimes. However, he had managed to escape and had been a bandit ever since. He had killed quite a few people during his bandit career, but he had never harmed any slaves. So slaves trusted him. Slaves liked him. He had this fame as a good guy. So Nerva now approached Titinius, and in this tactic that has been done over and over again in the previous rebellions, tried to bribe him. You know, offers him a deal, offers him a pardon, offers him money. In return, what Titinius has to do is to take some slaves with him and act as if he's about to join the slave rebellion. And once he gains the trust and confidence of the rebelling slaves, he's to betray their position to the Romans. Now, Titinius decides this is just a great deal. Being a bandit has been fun and all, but usually bandits don't have a long and healthy life. And so decide to take this bribe, betray the position of the rebelling slave to the Romans, who are therefore able to attack this group, kill most of them. The ones who are not killed, quite a few of them decide to jump from a cliff in an effort to avoid the punishment that inevitably would come once they were captured. So most of them commit suicide. Some are killed by the Romans. The whole thing is basically over before it even begins. It was a tiny macro rebellion. It seemed like it has been dealt with. The whole thing is barely a footnote in history. The soldiers are being sent home. Look like it's all over, but it's not, because another group of slaves decide to copy the model of the first, and they start killing their own masters. This time, the governor takes his sweet time recalling soldiers, and the number of rebels increase quickly. Nerva doesn't get a good reputation with his following actions, because the story is that when he marches out with the soldiers that he raises, he gets scared by the numbers of slaves who by now have banded together in this rebellion, and he does everything possible to avoid battle, giving, in the meantime, even more time to the rebels to swell their ranks with new recruits. The governor decides he doesn't want to deal with it, so he appoints Titinius as a commander and gave him 600 soldiers to try to deal with this. Well, Titinius and the 600 soldiers don't go very far because they lose to this slave rebel army that's being raised. And the rebels, basically, the only thing that happened with Titinius and the 600 soldiers go after them is that the rebels will say, well, thank you for the great weapons you brought to us that we didn't really have up until now, but now that we beat you, on top of it, we have your weapons. So by now, the numbers are rising quickly, so you now have about 6,000 rebels who join together in an assembly and decide to pick a man by the name of Salvius to be their king. It's clear that nobody's questioned the idea of monarchy. You know, even slaves, every time they start a rebellion, they nominate somebody as their king. Salvius, much like it had happened with the first slave war, Salvius is also a charismatic leader who has a fame as a prophet, as a religious leader, as somebody who got the gods to whisper in his ears. Now, the rebellion so far has been confined to western Sicily, but it slowly begins to push toward the east. In not too long, Salvius finds himself with about 20,000 infantrymen and 2,000 cavalry under his control. This is a big army. This is a big, solid army that Rome has no answer to, since all their men are being sent north to deal with the Cimbrian Teutones, as we keep saying. But this is the big problem that Rome is facing. He has to deal on too many fronts at the same time. In the meantime, the rebels attack the city of Morgantina, and they lay siege to the city. The governor Nerva marches in the middle of the night with some 10,000 allied troops and Sicilian soldiers to try to save the city from this siege. He attacks the camp of the slave army, which is mostly empty, since most of the men are now at the siege. He finds a lot of women who have been captured by the slave army during their raids and free them. So he's beginning to score some victory. It looks like he's beating some of the few people who are left in camp. But by the time the slave army realize what's going on, they counterattack and Nerva decide to flee. The soldiers don't stand their ground. Nerva's attempt fails. In the meantime, Salvius is also dealing with the people inside the city. So he has his men scream that they are going to spare anybody giving up their weapons and surrendering. So quite a few of the Roman soldiers under Nerva did this. Salvius sends the same message over the walls among those in the city, and he also sends an extra message. He basically tells any slave inside the city will be freed if you join us. This forces slave owners to play a bidding war. They end up offering freedom to their slaves as well. The deal is, they tell you that you're going to be freed. Don't take that deal. Because, yeah, sure, you're going to be freed for a while, but then Rome is going to send their armies, and they're going to crush you, and you're going to die a horrible death. We are going to offer you freedom. You are no longer going to be a slave if you stay with us and you actually help us protect the city from this slave rebellion. Most of the slaves in the city take their master's offer, and they join the ranks of those fighting to defend the city. The siege doesn't work. Salvius eventually has to give up. The siege is defeated. The governor, however, will quickly take back the grant of freedom that the slave owners had promised to the slaves who had helped defend Morgantina. So quite a few of them, very upset, now run away and join the rebels. In the meantime, much as it had happened with the first slave war, here also a second front opened up. A man by the name of Athenion, he was a Cilician. Cilicia was a part of modern-day Turkey. He had been a farm manager, he had been a pastor, and when all these rebellions were breaking out around him, he killed his own master and freed quite a few slaves, and was elected king by them. So here we have two guys, each one claiming to be king, Salvius and Athenion. Salvius, by the way, just because it's not complicated enough to have all these names, decide to drop the name Salvius and go by the name of Tryphon. I refuse to deal with it, so we'll stick with Salvius for simplicity's sake. Just one name. Salvius and Athenion, they get into an agreement similar to what had happened between the two main leaders of the Third Slave War, which is Athenion agrees to be Salvius' subordinate. Salvius, however, is not entirely sold on Athenion's sincerity. He's a little scared of him, so he has him arrested for a while. While in the meantime, Salvius is playing the king game, dressing up in purple, setting up an administration for the city. Eventually, Salvius realizes that he can trust Athenion, or maybe he doesn't trust him at all, he doesn't get to realize anything. It's simply that a threat is coming up, and he's going to need all the help he can get. In the year 103, before Common Era, 16,000 soldiers were sent from Rome under the leadership of Licinius Lucullus, who incidentally was the same man who had crushed the rebellion in Capua that we mentioned in 104 before Common Era, just a couple of minutes ago. Now, Salvius takes Athenian advice to engage in an open battle with Lucullus' forces rather than barricade themselves into the city. So they have this big open battle with possibly something in the neighborhood of 40,000 slaves fighting against the 16,000 men under Lucullus. The accounts tell us that the slave army is winning. However, their main general, Athenion, is wounded. And in order to escape with his life, he has to act as if he had dropped dead during the fighting. And he hid under the bodies of some of his comrades to make his escape when the battle was over during the night. The problem is that his apparent death created confusion in the slave ranks, and this allowed the Roman troops to rally and win as the slave ranks were breaking. Over 20,000 of the rebels were killed in this battle. This is a bad day for the slave rebellion. The survivors retreated at a place called Triocala and prepared for a siege. Lucullus' attempt to take the city failed, and quite a few of his soldiers died during this initial siege. So, much like other people before him, he decided, forget trying to take the city by force, forget trying to storm it, let's just take it by hunger. I'll just lay siege and wait for them to starve to death. In the meantime, Lucullus is recalled, because in Rome they were not, despite his success, because he had won a big battle, they felt that he was taking too long. They felt that the job could and should be done quicker and more effectively. Lucullus is mad. Extremely upset over being recalled and not allowed to have his name tied to being the guy who crushed the rebellion. He disbanded his army and destroyed all the supplies and siege equipment that he had set up. He's basically trying to sabotage his successor's work, which is kind of funny to notice how much egos play into these stories. You know, Lucullus should be happy regardless, right? If his side, if the Roman side wins, you know, if you're a good team player, that's what you care for. But maybe not. He decide that his wounded pride is more important to him than any kind of chat about team play or any notions like that. So again, he completely undermines the efforts of whoever is going to take over after him by destroying all the siege he had been careful to set up until this point. Not surprisingly, the new praetor sent to take over the job, Gaius Servilius, gets nothing done because he had to start from scratch again. In the meantime, Salvius, the king of the slave rebellion, dies. Sources are not really clear regarding why, what caused this death. Athenion became his successor and ruled much of the island, while at the same time Servilius was not really able to do much about it. Maybe Salvius' death had, maybe he was right to be suspicious of Athenion. Maybe Athenion had a hand in his death. Maybe he did not at all. We have no idea. With the historical record being silent, we can sort of speculate on this. In the year 101 before Common Era, the Romans get serious. They sent the consul, Manius Aquilius, who was co-consul with Gaius Marius during this year. They sent him to deal with this rebellion. In the big showdown between the rebel forces and the Roman armies, Aquillius personally kills Athenion in a duel. So here is, you have the big showdown, you know, the two leaders of the two armies face each other in personal combat, and Athenion get killed in the process. Aquillius, needless to say, well, his fame will rise as a result of it. He gets wounded during this fight, and he's gonna milk this to death later in life. There's a story where time after these events, he's going to be put on trial for corruption. And the story goes that there's quite a lot of evidence that he was guilty. But lacking good arguments to prove he's innocent, Aquillius tore open his toga and showed the jurors his scars from the fight, and the jurors decided to give him a pass. He's like, you may be corrupt, but it's true. You bled a lot for Rome. You got a pass this time. So in any case, Aquillius kills Athenion. Slave forces crumble. The rebels are killed by the thousands. There's about 1,000 of them survive, and they are captured. So Aquillius did what a good Roman general would do in this case, try to use the prisoners in the best possible way for his advantage, and he decided the best way to push his name even further to greater fame in Rome is to bring back these 1,000 slaves, to have them thrown to the beasts in the arena in Rome, either to put them in gladiatorial combat or to have them devoured by beasts for the entertainment of the Roman public. And this is where the story of the Second Slave War will end with a bang. The Romans are in a celebratory mood after their victory. And the problem is that when the Romans feel like celebrating, you can pretty much bet that somebody's about to die a horrific death as a result. Specifically, what the Romans decide to do is to gather about 1,000 rebel slaves who had been captured but had survived, bring them to Rome, and forcibly recruit them into the games. They were Rome's number one pastime. These are the same games taking place in the arena that usually included gladiatorial combat and other events. The event they have reserved for the rebel slaves is to pit them to fight against wild beasts until the last one of them is devoured for the viewing pleasure of the Roman public. For Rome, this is a great time. This will be a fitting celebration mixing public entertainment with unambiguous statements of Rome's dominance. Their message here will be, look what happens to those who challenge our power. But the rebel slaves decide they are not going to be part of this process. They will not let their deaths happen under the eyes of gloating Romans. What they do instead is that they cut each other's throat to deny the Roman public fun and the entertainment with their dead. They say, we're gonna die anyway. You know, we know we're not getting out of it alive, but we're not going to let our death be a source of amusement for the Romans. And so they decide to all kill each other. And this one guy, Satyros, was the last man surviving after they have all killed each other. He kills himself with the sword that he had just finished the companion with. And so every single one of them died. Diodorus Siculus, writing about this story, talks about Satyros, I quote, dying like a hero. So in a weird, odd way, the rebels redeemed themselves and have this kind of heroic, suicidal death that even the Romans ended up admiring. They admired their guts. They admired their commitment to live and die as free men in this case. This, in my mind, is one of the great examples of some historical underdogs using their own deaths to raise a defiant, metaphorical middle finger against the very power that has just crushed them. This is quite a powerful note to end with. And I say end with because I promised you guys three slave wars. We said there are three main servile wars in the history of Rome. We touch on the first two, but I'm looking at the clock and realizing a whole lot more time has gone by than I anticipated to cover the first two wars. Those of you guys who have been listening from the first minute, I deeply appreciate you sticking with it and play with me this long. I will not abuse your patience further. and I will save the biggest and baddest of the three slave wars, Spartacus Rebellion, for the next episode. Thank you for your attention over the last couple of hours. Now, if you don't mind a little bit of information how to make sure that this show stays viable, there are basically three main ways that the show can support itself. The first is through our sponsors. Again, as I mentioned at the beginning, we're sponsored by Onnit.com and ChimeraCoffee.com. I personally use all of their products. I've tried Onnit products for a long time and I've been very happy with them. I've tried Chimera Coffee and like it a whole lot. My mom actually swears that this is the best coffee she's ever had, and she's, you know, she comes from Italy where coffee is a religion, so that's high praise indeed. So sponsors are one way to go. If you guys can are interested in any of the things they can sell, use the links provided in the episode notes to get a discount, and they will know that you're listening and you're coming to their sites from me, and that will help me a whole lot. So that's option number one. Second option, even easier, you don't really have to buy anything other than what you're already buying, is Amazon link. If you go shopping on Amazon.com, please, please, please use the History on Fire Amazon link that will be found on the History on Fire podcast website. And that will also help tremendously without really costing you 1 cent more than what you would spend already to buy the stuff you normally buy. Last but not least, listeners' donations. If there are some sweet souls among you who decide that you like the show and you want to send a few bucks my way, I would deeply, deeply appreciate it. The donate button will be found on the History on Fire podcast website, and you can use it to send your support. For now, thank you very much, and have a wonderful day.